Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 6th of July, these are our main stories. Venezuela has released 22 people regarded by the opposition as political prisoners, including a prominent judge. President Trump has said he may use an executive order to include a controversial question on citizenship to the US Census. 8 Poles have been convicted of running what's being described as the largest modern slavery ring in Britain. Also in this podcast,
Babylon was one of the greatest cities of the ancient world. King Nebuchadnezzar's capital straddled the river Euphrates in a region that was the cradle of civilization.
The ancient city of Babylon, in what's now Iraq, has been added to UNESCO's list of World Heritage Sites. Venezuela's Supreme Court has released 22 people from prison, including a high-profile judge. María Lourdes Afiuni is one of many people the opposition say are political prisoners. She was first arrested 10 years ago and had been sentenced again in March for corruption. The UN Human Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, said she welcomed the news, which she hoped was a sign of change. On Friday, the opposition leader, Juan Guaido, called a march on the Secret Services headquarters in Caracas to mark Venezuela's Independence Day and to protest against the brutal killing of a detained military officer last month. But unlike earlier protests, few joined the demonstration. I spoke to our reporter Guillermo Olmo in Caracas as the march was taking place.
It's not as massive as this kind of rallies used to be when he first launched his bid against Nicolas Maduro's power. But I can see from here, I would say it's around 2,000 people here. They are holding Venezuelan flags and they are also waving banners asking for the end of torture and the end of dictatorship in Venezuela.
As you said, 2,000 people really pales into insignificance compared to the tens or hundreds of thousands that we've seen in previous weeks and months. That despite the fact that there was this big report from the United Nations condemning Venezuela, would you say that people are losing confidence that these protests can really have any impact?
Yeah, I would say that's the kind of mood you feel here. A long time it has become evident that street protests are not giving result in terms of bringing the political change that the opposition supporters hope. So some of them are tired and feel that this is useless, that they can show up time and again, and time and again Nicolas Maduro remains in power. There's a new source of anger coming from that report you mentioned, because it has been confirmed in that report with many local NGOs and also, journalists working in the country have been reporting for years that the human rights situation in Venezuela is dire, because we are talking about extrajudicial killings, we are talking about people kidnapped by security forces, we are talking about corruption that has wasted a lot of public money.
Now, the government has dismissed that UN human rights report, but there has been some movement from the Supreme Court today in an unrelated matter. The Supreme Court released some prominent critics of the president, didn't it?
We learned of the release of 22 prisoners, the prisoners that the opposition considers are political prisoners. And this is an announcement that came from the United Nations Human Rights High Commissioner, Michelle Bachelet, who is also the author of that report we are talking about. This is a significant move, because, especially because some of the names of the people included of that list. There is a very famous judge here in Venezuela. She's Maria Afiuni, and she's been released after being jailed since the time of former President Hugo Chavez. This was a case that has become a kind of symbol for the opposition, especially because she claimed that she had been raped while in prison, and because the opposition supporters considered that she was imprisoned only because not obeying Hugo Chavez's commands.
Guillermo Olmo in Caracas. President Trump has said he may issue an executive order to add a controversial question to next year's census, asking each person whether they are a citizen of the United States. Speaking in front of his presidential helicopter, Mr. Trump said the question is needed to find out the number of foreign nationals in the U.S.
We're spending $15 to $20 billion on a census. We're doing everything. We're finding out everything about everybody. Think of it. $15 to $20 billion, and you're not allowed to ask them, are you a citizen? And by the way, if you look at the history of our country, it's almost always been asked.
But his opponents say the measure is party political, as the census is also used as a basis for allocating seats in the House of Representatives and billions of dollars worth of federal services. The Justice Department said it was still considering how to proceed. From Washington, here's Barbara Platt-Usher.
The citizenship question is controversial because critics believe it's a ploy to scare immigrants into not participating in the census. That would mean an undercount of populations in Democratic districts with high numbers of immigrants, which would be significant because the census data is used to determine the distribution of federal funding and the number of congressional seats. The Trump administration said it wanted to ask about citizenship to better enforce a law that protects the voting rights of minorities. The Supreme Court said that rationale was contrived, but left the door open for government lawyers to come up with a more convincing one.
Barbara Platt-Usher in Washington. The United Nations has welcomed the power-sharing agreement reached in Sudan in the early hours of Friday. The Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, called on both the military and the civilian opposition to implement the deal fully. And Soy has more details.
This is the closest Sudanese have come to civilian rule in 30 years. Mohamed El Hassan is the Africa Union mediator.
The two parties have agreed to form the sovereign council equally between them, military and civilian, for the period of 3 years or more. And also they've agreed on a civilian government independently, technocrats led by a prime minister, which will be capable and work for the country.
A military general will head the sovereign council. That's the top decision-making body at the beginning of the transition, before handing over to a civilian who will lead the country to elections.
Anne Soy. The Tunisian government has banned the use of the niqab in public institutions like government offices. It said the decision was based on security reasons. The niqab covers a woman's entire face, leaving only the eyes visible. Tunisia has seen a series of Islamist attacks. In the latest, on Thursday last week, two people were killed in a suicide bombing in the capital, Tunis. 5 years ago, the police were given special powers to check people wearing the niqab in case it was being used as a disguise. Ben James heard more from BBC Arabic's Alma Hassoun.
The government has announced the ban of wearing the niqab in public institutions, and that's for security reasons, without elaborating more on that.
And is this something that's happened in Tunisia before?
Well, this is it's not unusual decision at all, because before the 2011 revolution, it was banned. Hijab and niqab was banned since the 80s. After the revolution, and then because we had different political powers came in Tunisia, including Islamists, then we start having changes in the society.
So it's going back to something similar to what had gone before. What's the reaction been amongst Tunisians? Has this been welcomed or not?
So far, nothing really. Like, we haven't spotted any political reactions from politicians or parties. And apparently, there is no anger among populations. Our reporter was just talking to some people there, because in 2015, for example, the Ministry of Education had also banned niqab in schools. So again, it's not unusual. And there is something we should also remember, that a niqab is not part of the women attire in the country. They have different, folkloric.
So it might not be something that many women are wearing, so might not really affect too many people who might want to wear it.
Exactly.
Very quickly.
Exactly. It's rare to have women wearing niqab. And also the constitution itself, guarantees the individual freedom. So, we might see some feminist or women rights groups demanding the right. However, it's really complicated in the society there.
Alma Hassoun from BBC Arabic. The United Nations cultural body, UNESCO, has voted to list the ancient Mesopotamian city of Babylon in present-day Iraq as a World Heritage Site. Babylon was first mentioned as a settlement more than 4,000 years ago. Alan Johnston reports.
Babylon was one of the greatest cities of the ancient world. King Nebuchadnezzar's capital straddled the river Euphrates in a region that was the cradle of civilization. The city was famous for its hanging gardens and the beautiful Ishtar Gate, one of the original seven wonders of the world. But the site suffered in modern times. It was damaged by work to construct a palace for Saddam Hussein, and damaged again by American troops who occupied the area. UNESCO describes Babylon as being in an extremely vulnerable condition and in need of urgent conservation.
Alan Johnston. Now, here's a thought. Why do we care where we come from? Why do stories matter? And why are we so fascinated by zombies? They're just a few of the questions that have been posed recently by The Why Factor. It's a podcast from the BBC World Service that looks at the things we do every day, often without thinking, and asks, why do we do that? The answers reveal extraordinary stories and hidden stories that'll make you think twice about objects and behaviours you take for granted. Just search for The Why Factor wherever you found this podcast. Why wouldn't you? 8 people have been convicted for running what's being described as the largest modern slavery ring in Britain. The gang leaders, all of them Polish, lured hundreds of people, including alcoholics, the homeless, and freed prisoners from Poland with promises of well-paid jobs. But once in the country, they were forced into heavy manual labour, threatened, humiliated, and beaten up. This report from Seema Kotecha in central England.
Hundreds of victims, some as young as 17, were lured from Poland to Birmingham. They were promised wealth and comfort, but instead were made to live in filth and squalor. They were given cramped accommodation in the West Midlands. Their rooms often had no light or heating and were sometimes infested with rats. The slave masters, as they were sometimes called by the victims, are also from Poland, and the 8 of them preyed on the vulnerable in their homeland. Former prisoners, the homeless and alcoholics were frequently targeted. This man was approached by the gang on the day he was released from jail. He worked for them for several months.
To be honest, I came here to start a new life, but I didn't know that this new life would start with such a really big problems. I couldn't even leave the house to go for a walk. They were following me, spying on me, they were controlling me.
The offenders, who police believe are members and associates of 2 Polish crime families, have been convicted of slavery, trafficking and money laundering offences during 2 trials. 3 men were jailed today, while 5 others were convicted and imprisoned in February. Between them, they've been sentenced to 55 years in jail. West Midlands police began looking into what was happening 4 years ago after being tipped off by a charity, Hope for Justice. They named their investigation Operation Fort. Nick Dale is the Detective Chief Inspector for West Midlands Police.
They would convince the victims, for example, that they were unlawfully in the country, that if they left the house that the traffickers provided for them, that they would be arrested by the police. Sometimes they were given a debt, so you know they were told that they owed the traffickers £5,000 and had to work off that debt. So there's a lot of these methods the traffickers would use to make them feel trapped.
The victims were often forced to work in factories, on farms and on recycling plants and kept as little as 50 pence a day from their earnings while their masters took the rest. In one case, a worker was given coffee and a chicken as payment for redecorating a house, while another man had to wash in a canal because he had no other access to water. While the victims suffered, the gang lived an opulent lifestyle, driving lavish cars and buying designer clothes. Over 5 years, they made at least £2 million. Ian Waterfield is from the Gangmasters and Labour Abuse Authority, which works to identify victims of trafficking.
How many of you think that your day-to-day life is touched by modern slavery? We'd probably all say, not me, but in reality, it probably is, whether it be the food you eat, the clothes you wear, when you get your car washed, when you get your nails done, when you get your hair cut, hotels you stay in, etc.
The judge, Mary Stacey, told the court the harm in this case was at the very highest level. She said they had subjected their victims to a demi-life of misery and poverty, robbing them of their human dignity. And she warned that all too often, such offences were being carried out in plain sight.
That report by Seema Kotecha. Families of 157 people who were killed when a plane crashed in Ethiopia in March believe Boeing's commercial motivation led to the death of their relatives. Flight ET-302 crashed moments after it took off from the capital, Addis Ababa. The Boeing 737 MAX aircraft was the same make as one which crashed in Indonesia in November last year, when 189 people died. Preliminary reports revealed that the same flight control system was at fault in both crashes. The families of some of those killed have been speaking exclusively to the BBC and explained the devastating effect the last few months have had on their lives. Simon Browning reports from North America.
I lost my wife, Carol, my three children, Ryan, Kelly and Ruby. And I also lost my mom-in-law.
What were those first hours and days like for you after ET-302 crashed?
It's devastating. I mean, Simon, I lost my past, my present and my future.
Paul Jaroge lost his entire family when ET-302 nosedived into the ground 6 minutes after taking off from Addis Ababa. Now he lives with friends, unable to return to the family home.
I think about my wife and my children every moment of my life. And I feel so lonely. And I look at people. I see them with their children playing outside. And I know I cannot have my children with me.
Paul's family died after the second Boeing 737 MAX crashed in 5 months. The first happened just off Indonesia last November. Preliminary reports have revealed the same flight control system was at fault. And now families in the United States and Canada want to know why there was a second crash. Chris and Clarice Moore's daughter Danielle was also on board the flight.
Another crash happened. And they tell us it will be this one of the safest plane. It's not the safest plane. It took away the lives of the people that we love so much. And no matter what they're going to say or do, it will never come back. It will never be the same. And our life, our normal life, will never be the same.
In the corner of their suburban home in northern Toronto is a tasteful but emotive shrine to their daughter. Pictures of Danielle smile down from the walls. Clarice plays a song her musician daughter recorded. In western Massachusetts, Nadia and Michael Stumo live among sprawling fields, forests and mountains. Their daughter Samia was also on board.
Everywhere we look, there's a blank where she should be.
Critics are asking if the development and launch of the 737 MAX was rushed. They claim Boeing was competing in the market with a new Airbus plane, and they question whether corners were cut to get the MAX into service. Nadia believes commercial motivation led to her daughter's death.
My daughter died for the profit of Boeing, and I don't want anyone else to die for that reason. I want these planes to be safe and invest in the company and the hardware and the infrastructure to make our aviation system safe.
For Paul, he feels the crash that killed his family should never have happened. Boeing should have grounded the jet after the first crash.
The crash of Ethiopian Airlines flight 302 was preventable. But these individuals knew that they would not be held criminally liable. They would not face years in prison. But if they knew that they would face years in prison, then they would have grounded those planes in November.
In a statement, Boeing said they are sorry for the tragic loss of life in these accidents and are focused on re-earning the trust and confidence of the public in the months ahead. But for the families, life is changed forever. They resolve now, finding the truth.
Simon Browning reporting. The Night Watch by the 17th century Dutch artist Rembrandt is one of the world's most spectacular paintings. Measuring 3.5 by more than 4 metres, it's viewed by more than 2 million visitors each year at Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum. And it's about to reach an even wider audience when a lengthy restoration of the work of art is live-streamed to millions around the world. Julian Marshall heard more from the museum's general director, Taco Dibitz.
Well, the Night Watch itself is a big deal. It's one of the most famous paintings in the world, also probably because it's one of the most innovative paintings in the world. Rembrandt, who always does something different, was commissioned to paint a group portrait of civic guards. And what he did, he didn't paint a portrait, he painted the story. And I think that that was something you... I sometimes compare it to a school photograph where you all ask to stand in line. Everybody runs around and after 10 minutes, everybody stands in line. The photographer makes a photograph. What Rembrandt did is he made the photograph before everybody was standing in line and everybody was still talking, running around, even firing a gun. So he was had a completely different idea of how to capture this moment of the civic guards marching out.
And what sort of global audience are you expecting to watch the restoration?
Well, over 2.5 million people come to see the Night Watch every year. Rembrandt, on the one hand, is a Dutch painter. It's a painting that's deeply rooted in the Dutch identity, but it is a painting for the world. Everywhere where we've gone as the museum, people love Rembrandt. I think people particularly like Rembrandt because Rembrandt paints us as we are, in all our beauty, in all our ugliness. We are who we are, and that's what he depicts.
Why is it in need of restoration?
We monitor the painting because it's such an important work. We monitor it every day. And over the past years, we've seen that there's a slight deformation in the canvas at the top. And we also see a white haze that's appearing in certain areas, which is probably on the varnish. But we want to understand exactly what the condition is. We will do what we could call a full body scan. So we'll do scanning of the painting with all different type of techniques so we really can discover what the painting is made of, how it was painted, in order to be able to preserve it better for future generations.
But you won't muck around with the colours. I mean, I ask that question because there have been shocking examples recently of paintings that have been over-restored and actually bear no resemblance to what was being restored.
Well, if you would ask me to do it, I'm not a restorer, it would be disastrous. But luckily, we have a fantastic team of conservators and scientists. I think over the past years, conservation has become far more scientific. There are techniques that we couldn't dream of 20 years ago that we have now to analyze the paint. And I'm sure that this team will be very cautious and will do a very good job.
Taco Dibitz, General Director of Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum. In the United States, a viral video stunt involving a vanilla ice cream could land a prankster with a very lengthy jail sentence. Cecilia McCauley reports.
As the rest of the US took time off for 4th of July celebrations, some police officers in Lufkin, Texas, weren't so lucky. Detectives have been working through the holidays on the hunt for an ice cream licker. This is after a video went viral showing a female, dubbed the Lufkin Licker, walking into Walmart, licking a tub of ice cream, then putting it back.
Lick it, oh, you foul, put it back, put it back, put it back, put it back.
The lick could cost her up to 20 years in jail for tampering with a consumer product. Lufkin's Director of Public Safety, Gerald Williamson, explained why.
It's because of the possibility of transfer of diseases or putting foreign substances in food products. And it's also very detrimental to sense of public safety. You know, if people can't trust the products that they go and purchase for consumption, it affects our commerce and so many things.
The ice cream brand Blue Bell have now pulled all half gallons of tin roof ice cream from the supermarket's shelves. Local police now say they know who they're looking for. But, for legal reasons, her identity cannot be published.
We found out this morning that our suspect is a juvenile female from San Antonio.
It's yet to see what charges she'll face in the juvenile justice system. So, for the public, the identity of the Lufkin Licker remains a mystery. For now.
Cecilia McCauley. A wooden statue of Melania Trump has caused controversy following its unveiling in her hometown in Slovenia. The work of art by the US artist Brad Downey has been described as a disgrace by some local people. Guy Delaunay reports from Slovenia's capital, Ljubljana.
The town of Sejonica is generally proud that it can claim Melania Trump as one of its own, but it sometimes has a funny way of showing it. Local artisans have marketed a variety of goods labelled First Lady, ranging from slippers to sausages. There's also a restaurant which serves a President burger featuring flyaway cheese hair. So perhaps the wooden statue on the banks of the River Sava should be taken in that spirit. It depicts the former fashion model in a bold blue dress and matching boots, but her figure is lumpen rather than elegant. She waves a club-like wooden fist in the direction of Sejonica Castle, and her bean-shaped face sports a distinctly disgruntled expression. These locals were not impressed.
It's not okay, it's a disgrace, that's what I have to say.
It doesn't bother me, but it's not nicely done. It could have been done better.
It doesn't look anything like Melania. It's a smurfette. It's a disgrace.
US artist Brad Downey said he was inspired by the mythical figure Echo, who was punished for concealing Zeus's infidelity. He commissioned Slovenian chainsaw maestro Aleš Zupevc to carve the sculpture from a tree trunk.
Guy Delaunay in Slovenia. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.